Hi everyone, welcome to another live recording of the Cheeky Natives. We have a fave of the Cheeky Natives and a very, very special guest, award winning author.
Yes!
Yes! Malebo Sipodi, who wrote The Beautiful Misbehaves. So I love to read the blurbs of books, right? Because that's what you do when you go to the shop. And I'm just going to give you a tidbit of what the blurb for Misbehaves is. When Malebo Sipodi first came across historian Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's quotes, well-behaved women seldom make history, she knew that she was tired of everyone else having a say in who and what she should be. According to Malebo, it is a norm for black women to live according to society's prescribed standards of what it means to be a well-behaved woman. But what happens when a black woman decides to live her own life and become who she wants to be? She's often seen as misbehaving. Appropriating Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's quotes, Malebo boldly renounces societal expectations and shares her journey towards achieving total autonomy and self-determinism. Misbehave is a conversation that will challenge, rattle, and occasionally cause you to reflect on your own life, daring you to ask yourself the question, are you truly living your life the way you want to? Come on, somebody, let the church say amen.
Amen.
All right, yes.
So, I mean, we're going to do things a little differently today. I've been thinking about how, like, we just jump into the conversation and it's, like, a little awkward. because, you know, the author comes with prepared. But I wanted to ask both of you, right, what are you currently reading? Like, what's on your reading menu at the moment?
Oh, Lord. My menu is quite extensive at the moment. I'm currently reading Mputsumi Ntabeni's
The Broken River Tent,
so that's what I'm reading. I'm also reading Celeste Ng, Little Fires Everywhere, fire. And I have just started Kintu by I've forgotten her surname, but that's what I'm reading at the moment, and it's interesting.
Okay, hi everyone. Hello. So I'm reading slowly Becoming. Becoming Michelle Obama, right? And it's okay. I'm slowly reading it. Mm-hmm. I just finished reading This Mournable Body by Tsitsi Dangaremba. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant, I mean, she writes brilliantly in a different narrative. And, you know, she takes us back to Tambo's life. And and although the setting is in Zimbabwe, because, you know, the black condition is a nervous condition, you really get to see the depths of it there. I'm not going to give any spoilers. And I just finished rereading The Man Falling from the Sky. What it means when a man is falling from the sky, right? And I read it. And then, you know, I had mixed emotions around it, mainly because of how I am with short stories. And then I had to go back to it. And I think I'd read like the first few chapters. And then going back to it was actually a different experience. And I find that the prose and like the way it's written is absolutely delicious. And everybody should read that book. Yeah. So that's currently what's been happening, and I'm reading a lot of academic texts.
Academia was the death of us. But it's funny because we spoke about that book, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky, as a Christmas holiday edition reading, because I think short stories are just an underappreciated art form. I think it takes a lot to write very succinctly and to still make people want to be like, I want to read that book, which is why everyone should also read Mohale Mashego's Intruders.
Yeah.
Black girls doing the most.
Yes.
Okay. What are you reading?
I'm reading Bell Hooks, All About Love.
In the month of love.
Yeah, so it's like, she's written this love trilogy, All About Love, Salvation and Communion.
Yeah.
And I was like, let me go revisit Bell Hooks.
I just want to put it out there. Can someone who, you know, is always liking my pictures and whatever, get me that trilogy?
And it's been interesting because in some ways reading Misbehave and revisiting All About Love, I saw some similarities about like just, you know, theoretical framings. So that was quite interesting you know, when you read, you know, Toni Morrison says, you know, you can't read a book once.
Yes.
You have to go revisit it. Even reading Misbehave the fourth time,
yeah.
I was just like, okay, maybe I didn't get this so clearly the first time.
I was snapping fingers, right? And people around me were like, what is going on? I'm like, it's this book, it's this book. And I mean, this is not a first read. It's like a third, fourth read, you know. Speaking of reading, we have a little thing that we like to get our authors to do, you know. So everyone who's in the audience, this is the great thing about having a live podcast.
Take out your Bibles.
You know that shade, guys. You know at black churches, when you come to church and you don't have your Bible and you're just feeling very awkward. When the pastor is like, and you're like, friend. So if you don't have your book here, please, can a friend who has their book here just be kind and share? We're reading on page, is it?
It's the chapter is chapter 8, Beyond the Quotas.
Mm-hmm.
I will let you know now.
Friend, I feel like
Kumam. It's on Fundis. Page 122.
I feel like Kumam Fundis, because you know Mam Fundis always reads. Mam Fundis is not getting to the page quickly enough.
Page
like
122.
Mam Fundis is in front, not at the back.
So just what we like to do when we record podcasts, right, is to give people a bit of a flavor of what the author has written, and obviously it's for the author to read it themselves. Mm. So Malebo, would you kindly read from here until here?
The ninth line. Okay, can I start?
Yes.
I learned that not all that looks progressive in our democracy advances black women. The figures present us as a progressive country from a gender equality perspective, but from where I stand, I have to disagree. The policies look great, and many leadership positions make beautiful statements about what women mean for the country. But when we need to see action, the picture is dim. I realized that as long as I advanced the status quo by keeping silent, I was not doing anything to advance the cause of black women. If I existed within that framework, being the first black woman at the table meant absolutely nothing. I personally find the first black narrative to be discomforting, but a colleague offered ways of seeing it in a positive light. She said that the position in my corporate company gave me access to decision-making opportunities, and instead of complaining, I could use that to our advantage. In retrospect, I see how that could have worked, but I can't see its practicality. There are not enough supportive structures at the top to keep you brave. Plus, you are busy fighting for your voice to be heard, never mind the voice of others. You run the risk of being co-opted into the machinery. Saying that the company has a black woman CEO might sound great and offer great inspiration, but is it enough? Is there a correlation between that and progress for all the other black women on the ground? When I say on the ground, I mean all the black women who live in rural areas, who run informal businesses, and those who are unemployed. There are questions that I need to work through, honestly. These are questions that I needed to work through honestly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Malebo. That was quite a wow start to this conversation. So one thing that's really been interesting for me is I read a lot of, like, I want to call them feminist texts, but a lot of academic feminist texts. Mm-hmm. And I find that Misbehave is written differently from the feminist text that I've read, right?
Yeah.
So I was really curious about the writing style and the writing methodology. In the introduction, you already said this is not a memoir or an autobiography. Mm-hmm. So it's a non-fiction piece of writing, but I want you to talk to us more about the decisions you made in writing and in deciding to write the way you wanted to write it.
Okay, so I think, let me start where I was before I joined the academic space. So I was in a finance area where my speciality was in science. And then I decided that it's all good being called one of the brightest minds in the country because of a certain stream and a kind of company that you're working in. But what does it matter if you can't grasp the social aspects of what's happening around you, right? So let's take, if you're an economist and you're here making big decisions or analyzing the economy of the country, but you have no grasp of what's happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. The decisions that you make are just very much like scientific, and they have no bearing about who's around you, who exists around you. So I decided that in order for me to understand society better, I needed to go back to school and learn theory. So I went and I went to Wits and I did a political course. And it was really, you know, enlightening, encouraging. And then one day I went to this seminar and they were presenting a paper on race. And words like epistemology and pedagogy were being thrown around, right? And everybody in the crowd was like, and I didn't want to be left out, right? And I'm like, but I had no idea what was going on. And the person next to me who kept on going, writing notes, had no idea what was going on. And then I realized that there's this huge distance between the work that's done in academia and the society that it's done for, right? So as I progressed in academia and the language became norm and I started writing like that, one thing that I always asked myself is, why did I come back to the space? And I came back to the space to understand society better. For who? For society, right? And then I also understood that the work that we do in universities is meant to enrich the community. So if you research something, it should enrich the community that you're researching for. Otherwise, then we become the same kind of people, like the Western people that gazed at certain bodies and saw certain bodies as anthropological studies, right? So there's no difference between me and those people. So I then started thinking about, if I were to take this amazing research that we conduct in the university space and actually present it to the community, what would that look like? And I really realized that there is a sense in writing accessible language, right? Mm. And so when I wrote this book, one of the things that I wanted to achieve is I wanted to speak to the non-churchgoers. Right? And when I say non-churchgoers, you know the saying when they say you preach to the church, you preach to the choir. So I wanted to speak to the non-choir members, right? Because as feminists, when we are together, we have the words. If we say cis hetero, we know exactly what you're saying and we snap the fingers. But there's a community out there that has no clue what you're saying. So I then decided that I want to have a conversation that's beyond the choir. I wanted to be able to speak to anyone, right? To anyone who's seeking, to anyone who's asking questions, especially around feminism. I wanted to be able to give this book to my great grandmother, and she must be like, oh, hansori feminism, kitsona tse buang katsona, right? And one of the ways that I did that is then I thought hard about experimental writing. You know, when you think about achieving something through different modes of writing, I looked at South Africa and what it is that we enjoy. First of all, we enjoy storytelling, right? We enjoy ngosi. We like people's details.
Yes.
And then I thought, okay, fine. So I'm going to take these difficult concepts and theories and put them in my experiences, you know, to show what feminism looks like, what social constructivism looks like in lived experiences. And one of the ways that I sought to do that is I'm going to tell my story as honest as possible, because I wanted the reader to find themselves in my story. Not necessarily have the same background with me, but I think when you hear someone's story, what that does, it kind of probes you to think about yourself, right? To say, okay, if my label was in this situation and she was thinking like this, you know, let me put myself in a similar situation, or let me think about when I was confronted with certain things. And so that was the writing, the incorporating the story bit. And then how I actually structured the book, if you read it, you see there are a lot of page breaks, right? I also wanted people who be like, you know, those people like, oh my gosh, I don't read, you know, like I can't, like I don't like reading. I wanted to be able to say, you know, you will read Misbehave. And one of the ways is when you get to the page breaks, I don't know if you've seen this, when you get to the end of a chapter, you feel like, yes, I went through that. And that's the thing about page breaks. When you read it, you feel like, yo, I've achieved, hey? I've gone through that and I've come to the end, I can go to the next one. And I think with the structure, and it's not infantilizing anyone. It's not saying that you have no ability to read, but it's to be able to just experiment with the way that we write so that you can appeal to a bigger group of people. And I think we need to have that space in our community where we experiment with writing, where we write different genres and we write different ways. So it is quite a long form answer, but you know, if I have to summarize it, I wanted to be able to take these difficult concepts and just make them accessible. I wanted to look to see what accessible writing looks like. And since writing Misbehave, it's really helped me with my academic writing, because in the past I thought it's a must, you know, to write this way. But now one of the way that I rebel in my academic journey is to write in ways that that is accessible. And I've actually realized that I don't care much about appearing in journals, because you know, I used to care a lot about tenure, making tenure so I can be a professor one day. But now I don't care much about appearing in journals. I care a lot that my work that I do, like if you spend 2 years researching something, I care a lot that it will go into the hands of those that it needs to reach. Yeah, so in short.
There's so many quotables in the statement that Malebus just made you in response to the question that you gave her. And I think it's a sort of a conversation that people are having around the world. There's been so much emphasis on like STEM and why we need STEM and. But we're starting to see that you can't possibly have this rise in STEM without having an equal rise in attention to humanities, right? Yeah. Because, I mean, even the technology that gets designed is being designed by humans. The programs that are being coded are being programmed by people, right? And if people have their own inherent biases or their own problematic thinking that they haven't worked through, what does that then mean for STEM moving forward, right? What does it mean to have people who make all of these apps and develop all of these things who don't have a firm grasp of what's happening on the ground, you know? And I think just even reading this and then realizing that Malebo was a science graduate also just made me think, I don't think that we can just relegate the thinking to other people, right? That even in whatever field you find yourself in, there's a massive responsibility on you to do the work of just rethinking your own, I don't know, inherent ideas that you've held on to forever because this is your culture. Yeah. And it must be that way, you know? But like you're saying, this book is very intimate, right? And it's very personal as well. And I think there's a vulnerability that comes with writing about yourself and knowing that it's out there. Because once you've written the story, the book has been published, it's out there, right?
Yeah.
Did you at any point have any reservations about writing about any topics, you know, because then you'd know that this was out there, your mom's gonna read this book. And you wrote about sex.
Oh wow. I mean, I think for me, when I realized that I have to actually use my story, and when I realized the depths that I had to go to, I think that was just a trigger for anxiety after anxiety, you know, episodes. I remember at one time I would just outsleep and I'd have this nightmare about somebody reading a piece of my life, right? And then I'd wake up like in a sweat thinking, oh my God. But one of the things that I really struggled with was when I wanted to unpack sexuality, right? So there's a chapter where it's SEX, and I wanted to unpack sexuality in a way that I think is accessible. But in order for me to do that, I had to look at my vagina, right? I had to look at my valve. And one of the things that I had to write about was my clitoris. And so my mom, ke mamfundisi, ke muruti. And then thinking about what she's going to think, here is this woman writing about her clitoris, because it's such a taboo in the church, right? So I'm thinking, I mean, I've worked through my emotions of how I feel about the church, etc., but I'm thinking about that mother who's going to come to her and say, "Unzore rere la manwana how ke lo ngwana ka di clitoris," right? And so I feel like how I actually reasoned through that was writing this in itself, like the whole text in itself was a resistance, was misbehavior. So the whole text on SEX was actually undoing a lot of taboo, you know, ideas around how we talk about our bodies, you know, how we think about our reproductive organs, if I have to put it that way, and how they're so tied to who we are and identities, and how all that conversation and the discourse around that, all the conversation around that is really based on power dynamics, right? Through a certain structure, patriarchal structure, that has said you need to be either this or that, and this is how you behave. And I wanted to really undo all of that. And then I thought, you know, one of the ways that I have to undo this is to bravely then go ahead and talk about this. If I say something in a text and I say, really, this is just an organ, then I have to be brave about it. I have to start believing and embodying that. And that's how I got over it. And there's a lot of other things as well that I had to really open myself up to and deal with them as I was writing. But then it took me back to the whole idea of how we've been seen as Black women. We've been seen as certain caricatures, right? And this is how you need to behave, and this is how you shouldn't behave. And for me, being vulnerable was also one of the ways that I actually pushed back against that narrative of how Black women should be strong and no one cares about your problems and nobody cares about your vulnerabilities because you are in Bogoto. And so for me, laying it out and saying, a lot of people, when they see me, they see this powerhouse, the super what, but here I am saying, these are the things that I've been, you know, dealing with, and these are the things that I've been going through. And in feminist theory, we talk about the political, you know, the personal being the political, right? How our personal lives, everything about us, and you know, how we interact with ourselves, how the world interacts with us, is politicized, right? And I wanted to show the power dynamics of how those things become. Why is it that my body is so political? It's really political. It goes up to parliament, where somebody will say the way that you're dressed, right? When a member of parliament is giving a speech, and then another member of parliament will say, yeah, first look at your body, or look at the way you're dressed, how that correlates, right? Or thinking about how you look and how everything is politicized. So dealing with those vulnerabilities and writing about those places was really an act of rebellion. It was an act to push back against a certain narrative.
I could just listen to Malibu speak all day, right? It's just me, like, the whole time. Like, I can tell, even in the audience, people are nodding. And I just want to be like, yes! But nobody's yassing. So I'm going to gather myself, you know? I'm just going to come within myself.
So I felt like in some parts I was reading this as a novel, because you're speaking about, like, how, as people, we like storytelling. And I know that these are real life people, but for purposes of this conversation, I'm just going to call them characters. So you speak really powerfully and quite extensively about different types of Black women in your life, right? But there are two women that you speak about in particular. The one woman is your mom, who you dedicate this book to, because as you say, she taught you to be brave. And the other woman is like my favorite person in the book, Kosi. Who is your friend, and a lot of stories that you and a lot of discussions and things that you go through because you've spoken to Kosi about that. So the one question is, like, do you feel that since you've published Misbehave, the relationship with your mother has been different to what it was before? And then connected to that is, do you think that Kosi is a model for you about friendships? Because, like, both Ama and I have been speaking a lot about, like, how we feel like Kosi is, like, everyone's friend. I want her as a friend because, you know, she makes it. So do you think that Kosi has really modeled what friendship should look like for you?
And sorry, just to add on to that, you've written a lot about, like, relationships in the book, and I want to know why it was so important to place so much emphasis on your relationship with Kosi, right? And your friendship with Kosi, right? And I think it just, I guess my question is related to the fact that we don't often see friendships between women type, like, highlighted in that way, right? Unless they're former friends and now they're frenemies or whatever, or they're fighting, or women don't support each other.
Okay, so I think with writing the book, the relationship that I have with my mom has been strengthened somewhat, simply because there's a there's a way people receive information if you're directly speaking to them versus if they're reading it, right? So because we can interrupt and we get in our own way and we speak past each other. So my mom, she's an activist and she's been in politics, but then she had this sojourn into Christianity, and a lot of her ideals are really Christian based, right? And there was a lot of things that she didn't understand, some of the decisions that I had made that she didn't understand, because according to her, there were a lot of my feminist ideals were anti-Christian, right? So for example, I would say that I don't really think much about the institution of marriage, right? But if by some miracle I get married, I would never see my partner who as a head, right? I would never see that thing. And that contradicts everything that the Christian faith teaches. So after I wrote the book, she started reading this book and actually realized that a lot of the things that I'm saying are not so far from what she believes in. And I think it also took her back to her political days, and even in the church, she's quite a feisty and who fights to break certain norms within the church. And then I think she realized that there's actually no difference, you know, with what Malebo is saying here, to a point where she started using the book as you know, during the manyano, she started using, because they were part of this interdenominational group, and she started using this book, started reading stuff from about the clitoris, right? And started reading things that I was hiding from her. And I was like, you're reading that? Wow, I should have written more, man. I should have gone deeper. But anyway, you know, she started reading these things, the chapter on self-care especially, right, to these gatherings. And for me, this changed the kind of conversation we were having. I was no longer trying to defend certain decisions that I was making, but here we were coming together and actually saying a lot of things complement the ideals that we both have. So if anything, this book for me was an embodiment of who she is, right, and who she was, because I grew up watching her, and a lot of the things that I think about are what she has taught me. The second that's a very tough question for me to answer, but the second question on black women and friendship, I wanted to make sure with Misbehave that not only in text but in a lot of other ways that it talks to the questions that we bring up, right? So we always talk about citing black women, talking about black women, resurrecting black women, right? Because there's this notion, especially in feminist spaces, that whenever we quote black women, it's always American feminists, right? American black feminists. And when we talk about our inspirations, I'm sure if you go through Twitter and Instagram, you know, if Serena Williams does something, we are like, yes, yes, yes. You know, if Beyonce does something, we're like, yes, yes, yes. But I don't really see much of that when it comes to our own South African women, and I still stand by it. Maybe it's because of this whole familiarity breeds contempt, I'm not sure. But what the book sought to do, it sought to say, actually, you know, black women have been writing. Black women have been doing things. There are notions that black women don't work together, can't be friends, and they're always in competition. And I wanted to show it in the most simplest way, how black women are there for each other and the kind of work that they do with and for each other. And I'm sure you pick that up through the soul over stories, etc. But one of the biggest stories that I anchored in was Khosi. You know, what happens when you cite black women? Because I think for me, directly quoting Khosi was citing her, saying, here are these amazing things that I've learned from this human being, and I want to document all of these things. And in, you know, around that, I wanted to show what this friendship meant for me and what it looked like. And she is a true model of friendship, right? Because I went to high school with her, and I'm still, like, she's still my best friend. and I might feel unworthy for the kind of love that she gives me. And even in my unworthiness, she understands where I'm coming from. Have you ever seen when you relate with someone, and we have these quotes, if somebody's not making you feel good about yourself, walk away from them. If the person in your group is not a millionaire, walk away from them. You know, those kind of quotes. And I think these quotes don't really take it, they don't think about context, right? Mm. So I could be going through some stuff. Like last year, I fell into a dark hole of depression, and I was not the nicest person, right? And I felt like people like Khosi understood my background. They knew that, okay, this is what Malebo is going through. She's not the nicest person. She has nothing nice to say. She's always crying. She's always like sad. But I'm still going to be there for her because I understand the context. And with black people, we always have context. And to say things nilly-willy without thinking of the context is really undermining our experiences. And so this is one of the things that Khosi has taught me. We posted up, you know, toxic people. I was toxic last year. Toxic people will only, you know, prevent you from reaching your success, and all of those capitalist ideals that we, you know, that we snap at. But if you think about it, if we really have to think about what feminism is and how we should embody it beyond the theory, it's in these kind of small acts, you know, that we, you know, that we have, and how we relate to each other. So I'm trying to create this nice succinct answer, but I'm just going in circles. But basically she embodies what black love is, right? That black Lekhonolo spoke about reading bell hooks is all about love and thinking about what does love mean in this space and how do we become safe houses for each other. And I wanted to show that without saying it or without writing it, but actually writing the different interactions that I've had with Khosi that has really shaped a lot of what I think or how I've thought through things. And we really should think about our journeys, because our journeys don't happen in silos, right? We constantly get in conversation with each other, and these are the conversations that kind of shapes our ideals, that shape, you know, what we think about and how we put ourselves, you know, in this world. Yeah,
I think it was interesting to reread Misbehave in February, the month of love, particularly because there's such an emphasis on romantic love, right? Like, you go on Twitter, you go on Facebook, you know, there are memes about Valentine's Day and those of us who are going to be alone on Valentine's Day and whatever, right? And there's an emphasis almost on friendship as a subsidiary to romantic love, right? Like, friendships are great, but that romantic love often gets a lot of, like, attention, yeah. You know, and it seems to treat friendship, particularly among women, as a nice to have, but not a necessity, you know, in ways that it doesn't do for romantic relationships. And I mean, that was just a powerful thing to think about in reading the book, because I'm just like, imagine if everybody had a Khosi, you know, imagine if everybody had that kind of level of interaction with a friend in their lives outside of this romantic axis that we all seem to be spinning on, you know. And speaking of relationships, there was the relationship between well-meaning patriarchs, you know, and benevolent patriarchy. Because I think benevolent patriarchy is a thing, you know, where I am oppressing you, but it's only because I care about you. And it's only because I want the best for you, you know. And I found that revisiting Dear Black Men was a lot for me, right? So when I first read Dear Black Men, I'm like, Malebo, what? You know? But then I realized that we've all had a dear black man moment, you know? And so, I mean, you had the opportunity to revisit the Malebo who started Dear Black Men and the Malebo who wrote Misbehave. And I'm just curious about what your reflections on that are now.
And I think also related to that is the space that we're finding ourselves in now is a space of volatility, right? Like, where black women, and women in general, but particularly black women, black queer folks, are really in trouble, right, because of the patriarchy, like how fragile and how it manifests itself, right? So for me, in thinking about like this hashtag black man, I was thinking about even like, you know, trigger warning, speaking about like hashtag of surviving R. Kelly, but also thinking about like the global conversation about Me Too, right?
Yeah.
So what did you hope to achieve when you were writing Dear Black Man? Because in some ways it also speaks about what like Bell Hooks speaks about. She speaks about this idea of in movement building there is love, right? So in writing Dear Black Men, it wasn't a, hey, black men, you are trash, you know, type of thing. Because we could just say that.
Yeah.
It was more speaking about, like, these are the things that you are doing to me that you may not know because of where you are. So what were you trying to achieve writing that? And what are your feelings now?
Yeah. I think for me, that chapter was trying to explain why hashtag men are trash exists, right? And I wanted to show the power of conditioning and the power of how these systems operate and how all of us, right, have been in some place conditioned or like manipulated, or this system was at play in our lives at a certain place. Because if it's not happening in the home, it's happening within the country, it's happening in the classroom, it's happening in different settings. There are certain systems that say this is how we exist, right? There can only be A and B, and this is how this A and B operate. So the binaries are there's male, there's female, and these are how the male and female operate, and this is the hierarchy. The male is here, the female, and then the child, and there's nothing outside of that. And for me, I wanted to show how this conditioning happens even when you are dedicated to the work of black women. So here I was, I started on an organization, and this organization was also an experiential organization because here I was as a black young woman going through the most, right? Living with the reality that I had been raped and abused, and then how do I navigate that? And I navigated that through starting an organization that spoke to black women and children who are living through the most horrendous circumstances. And one of the things that I found while working in that organization was that a lot of the issues experienced by black women, by black queer people, was really at the root of it was brought on by men, right? And one of the things that I sought to do was then go into correctional facilities, which were previously called prisons, go into correctional facilities and work with these men and find out, why is it that you're like this? Why is it that every single black woman that we encounter, every single queer person that we encounter, at the root is these violent masculinities? I just wanted to find out. But then I got like really, you know, like lost and embroiled in the whole thing when conditioning kicked in, because I started getting a lot of cries from men saying, oh, woe is us, you know, so over, why are you only focusing on women? Black men get raped too. You know how that conversation usually happens when we're talking about black women, and then a black man will come in and say, but black men get raped too, right? What about us black men? So that happened, and that like Inshapile left, and I said, yes, you are right. So I started incorporating everyone, you know, women and men in the organization. I started men mentorship programs, young boys, you know, it was that. When I went into prison, a lot of the stories that came out in the correctional facilities is that what was clear was that these men were wounded men, right? They would tell me their most hurt stories, and the pain would be raw. And in my mind, I justified, or I tried to understand, not justify, I kind of tried to understand the behavior, right? Because this is essentially what they were saying to me, that the reason why I'm a rapist is because I've been raped too, right? And because we live in a society that privileges men's emotions and existence over women's, it only makes sense that as a woman, you do not want to live in a place where men are inconvenienced, right? So it happens. I think we also see it with race, where if you're sitting in a bus or a train or somewhere, and a black person is sitting down and a white person walks in, because of this conditioning of apartheid, it's almost like a automatic reflex that the black person will stand up quickly so that the white person is comfortable. So it works in the same way with patriarchy, where women, you know, there's a conditioning that you it doesn't matter what you feel like, put yourself last because you're the pillar or whatever. Mm. And then here's this group that needs to be prioritized. And for me, it was like, oh my word, these people are being hurt. They need to be saved. They need to be helped. Mm. We need to exercise compassion, right? And I did a little exercise during that time where I wrote a fiction story of a girl being raped and a boy being raped. Mm. And the reactions to the two stories were quite telling. Because with the girl being raped, people were like, oh, that's so sad. You know, I relate. Oh, because, you know, we live in a society where girls are raped and it's the norm. Where people read the story about the boy being raped, people were like losing it. They were like, this is painful. This is like, remove this, Malebo. This is like unheard of. Oh, and you could see the different reactions, right? And for me, I also tell, and I also highlight that in a certain passage where I talk about when I came out to say I've been raped, and when a man came out and said he's been raped, the kind of pain, you know, that's shared, or the compassion that's shared with that person. And so this is how we conditioned. And here I was running this organization that said we are here to heal black men, and one of the ways to heal black men is because we've been told black men have an ego, so let's stroke their ego, let's tell them you're so nice, dear black men. So this was a whole campaign where we would have these dear black men. These dear black men were eating it up, and they were phoning in radio stations saying Malebo has the Da Vinci code. This is how it's done, right? When you drive with a woman, she mustn't tell you turn right. If she knows where you're going, she must just say, you know, sometimes it's a good idea to turn right. And he says, yes, let's turn right. Make it his idea, not yours. So this is where it was bordering on. Until, like, I explained the whole experience, mm-hmm. until a point where I actually thought to myself, nah, man. When I started thinking about my existence, my mom's existence, my grandmother's existence, like, okay, so my grandfather, he was brutalized by the apartheid system. My grandmother was brutalized by the apartheid system. And then she gets home and she's brutalized by my grandfather. I'm not saying that, but I'm just, you know, I'm making an example. Why is it that then my grandfather's behavior is justified and my grandmother's behavior is not? Like, here I am, I've been raped, but I'm not going around saying I rape because I've been raped, right? And I was like, there's a certain kind of accountability and standard that we hold for women versus men, right? And there's a lot of things where we see women organizing, women doing all these things in order to heal, in order to find justice, but on the other side, nothing is happening. And to dismantle patriarchy, to stop rape, etc., I'm not going to achieve that. You know, queer people are not going to achieve that. Black women are not going to achieve that. But the people who benefit from the system are going to achieve that. And so what I was trying to do with the chapters, I was trying to show why it is that we say hashtag men are trash. I was trying to show what I mean when I say don't put your experiences above mine. Don't erase my experiences for us to think about the black man's experiences, because this is what's been happening. So it was a model that was built just to show how we think about this issue and how we should, like, look at it from different angles. And I quote Professor Kopano Ratele, who's written Liberating Masculinities. I quote different texts that talk about how would we look at it from a different angle. So that was a whole chapter trying to go into the mind of what happens when we make excuses for violent masculinities, and what will continue to happen if we continue to make these excuses. Because during the hashtag Dear Black Man campaign, nothing changed, especially those who were part of the campaign clapping their hands. Nothing changed, right? They'll be like, I'll be there, and I'll be there helping you with this male mentorship program, and nothing was being done. And I was showing the complacency that happens when we continually carry these rocks on our heads as black women. And that was just what I was trying to do with the chapter. And obviously at the end of the chapter, a lot of people say I need to expand the chapter and give more space to the end of the chapter and go through those, you know, those changes, etc. The end of the chapter, you see how then we think about feminist theory and what then it says to that kind of behavior. And I find that when the book came out, a lot of men, when they read, because I didn't write the book for men, I was just like, whatever, if they read it, they read it, if they don't, they don't. But those who read it, it's like, you know, when they read that chapter, they were like, oh wow, you're speaking to us. And I'm like, I've heard that before, you're speaking to us. I'm tired of your marches and you're speaking to us. We really need to see action now, right?
Yeah, like, saying not all men.
Because you're speaking to us, now we understand you've liberated us. Like, it doesn't matter anymore. We just want to see action now. Yeah.
It's really interesting for me, right? Because like, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking even about like, when we're talking about this hashtag black men and thinking about all the ways of working with black men, right? We sometimes, even when we talk about gender-based violence and when we talk about sexually gender-based violence, we still position men. Mm. So, like, I remember some celebrity, but I just don't remember who, was talking about, like, how, oh, you know, guys, what we need to do is we need to ensure that we don't rape because it could be your mother, it could be your sister, it could be your... I'm like, oh, so we're only raping when it's someone close to us. How about we just not rape? Because Malebo is a human being, you know. So for me, my thing is also like, I think that there is a lot of accountability that men still have to do on their own. I think that as marginalized groups, as oppressed groups, we've constantly been doing the work. And misbehave exists, right? So why should we want Malebo to come talk to people when the product exists itself? So let them come and read for themselves.
But also it speaks to the idea that being oppressed yourself doesn't excuse you from doing the work of not being problematic.
Right? Yeah.
So in the same way that black men are oppressed and there are also ways in which they perpetuate the oppression of other groups, right? So in the ways in which they, and I think it's such a powerful chapter that you've written, I think this should be required reading for a lot of men, right? It's like the next time, I feel like the next time a man asks me, but what do you want black men to do? I'm just like, how about you read this book and do the work, maybe, you know?
And just to add on that, there's a thing, and I think I wrote it in the book, where when it comes to oppression, it's power dynamics, right? And it just manifests in different ways. So for example, when we think of racism, when we think of patriarchy, when we think of sexism, all these isms, right? And so there is this notion when it comes to race and being marginalized as black people, there's a position that black men take, and it's a no-nonsense position that says whiteness must account, etc., etc. But it's then difficult to look at it from the other way, to say, well, here is the system that I am benefiting from. I don't see myself, accounting and being held to a certain standard the way that I do it the other way. So the same kind of rage that racism gets met, I think patriarchy as well, we need to see it in that kind of light.
I like that, because someone said that black men understand nuance and lived experience when it comes to race, and they just have a full comprehension of what nuance and lived experience is.
Yeah.
Until black women start speaking about the ways in which they are violent and oppressive towards them, then suddenly it's like crickets. This is too academic. I can't follow this discourse. You're just attacking me, and not all black men, not all men, right?
But can I tell you how serious this is, right? Like, this is even ventured out into academy, right?
Yeah.
When black men are now writing about black masculinity or black male privilege, right?
Yeah.
So there are people literally like wanting to denounce the idea that because they are marginalized groups of people, they're not able to benefit and simultaneously be oppressed and perpetuate the same systems that they're trying to move away from, right? And I think this is a perfect segue into, I think one of my favorite chapters in the book is Beyond the Quotas. Obviously precursed by sexism, and then we're moving on to that.
And the magical Negro, right?
I mean, we've all been like working at corporate South Africa, and we know corporate South Africa and the racism, just the racism, right? And I want us to talk more about that, about the idea of what happened when you're writing about this, because you've went from an activist space, then you went to this big corporate, and then you were like, peace, I don't want to do this anymore. So tell a journey with us about like that chapter in particular.
But also then wants to ask Malebo to talk about her aha moments, right? Because I think often we seem to think like our favorite woke people arrived at woke, like they were born into wokeness, you know, like they came out of the womb, they grew up and they were woke, you know, and we don't often give credence to the aha moment that happens, right? Because we seem to think that you arrive at this journey and it happens. But I like that in this book you had your aha moments where you went from being the good, you know, the good black who assimilates, the good black who is palatable, and then you went into the Malebu that was just fire, fire, fire. And I'd like you to really take us to that aha moment.
I mean, Misbehave is about a journey, because I feel like in a lot of the texts that I read, I never see that journey, right? We only read about your arrival moment, and it feels like when you, okay, not the arrival moment, but you know, that moment where you had a woke space or a conscious space, and it always feels like that erases that journey. And I think living in a country like South Africa, where a lot of things have been built on these systems like racism, classism, etc., it's important for us to talk about those journeys, because you know, all of us, or our great grandparents, etc., were subjects of oppression, right? Like, so there's some stuff that has happened that we have inherited that we need to talk about. So this is what Misbehave was doing. Was saying, yeah, I mean, if you see me, I'm woke, but it comes from somewhere, and I've had to deliberate about a lot of things. And maybe this is where there's a gap that exists, and we see it on Twitter, right? We have this woke Twitter, and this, I don't know what we call Twitter. I really don't know. I'm not part of the woke Twitter. It's not my generation. I'm part of the conscious Twitter, right? I was born in the 80s, early 80s, right? And I find that there's this whole generational vibe that goes on. But also, you know, there's always this gap between wokeness and, I don't know, sleeping. I get it, because the opposite of being awake is asleep, I guess. But anyway, So, what actually informed this journey, I'm just going to quickly go out of your question and I'll come back. What actually informed this journey was a conversation on Twitter between, I think it was an alcoholic brand that was hosting this round table, and here were these women sitting going, to be a good woman, you must be a good wife. Every day I bake scones, and when my man comes home, the scones are like really whipping in the air. And he goes, oh, you know, and things like that. Like, if a man says something and you get upstairs, just close your teeth and don't, you know, like just, you know. And there were all these things that we grew up hearing, you know, we grew up hearing them. And then there was this huge response from the other side that was like, whoa. Then I thought, what would happen if there was a conversation in between the two, like the two sides, right? And that conversation is the journey, because there is a trek that happens in a lot of our lives. Some people arrive earlier, some people don't. And due to the generational gaps that we have and the kind of systems that are operating at that time, obviously if you are under an oppressive system like apartheid and when patriarchy was rife, that journey takes a bit longer than if you are in a different system where, you know, we're still navigating, we officially out of the books of apartheid, but there's still nuances there. So that journey becomes quite different, and I wanted to talk to those generational gaps, and that's why Misbehave exists, and it talks about that journey. And one of the things that I'm always interested in, even in my academic work that I write about in terms of misbehaving, is this idea of economic freedom, right? So we all talk about economic freedom, but then we all talk about capitalism. And then I wanted to look at it from a lived experience. What does that look like? And a lot of us, we know what money does and we know what status does. And in our own ways, we desire money, we desire status, even though some of our ideologies say otherwise. And one of the ways that black people get into this money and status kind of narrative is through the corporate sector, right? Through going to school. Once you graduate, you get a job. And this job will allow you then to live a certain life that you fantasized about. You are first generation and none in your family have lived like this before. But also, we don't interrogate enough what happens in the corporate. And I think for me, coming from a place where, you know, there was what we call freedom in South Africa, and with this freedom came this euphoria, of you will get all the jobs you want, everything, yes, we are free. There was this whole euphoria and we are equal. Then you come in and you rush into corporate and you think everything is equal and fair, and bam, you get hit by certain realities that you see happening. It's like the undertones, and during that time there was a lot of undertones that put you back in your place, right? And so I just talk about that journey of how when I was in corporate, just a small thing like the language policy, right, where we live in a country where there are certain amount of languages that are official, right? We say there are 11 official languages, but in the corporate space at that time they only wanted us to speak one language. And if unobuaka Setswana or ukhuluma ngesiZulu, you'd be told don't speak that language here, right? You speak something that's understandable. And you start experiencing that in corporate where it starts undermining who you are, because a lot of identities are so tied to the languages that we speak. It starts questioning, you start questioning and undermining who you are, even your accent. So I make an example where somebody called during, like, when we were in the office, and then somebody was like, you know, this person called, but you can hear this person is doof, right? And then I'm like, how do you hear that this person is doof? Through their accent. They have such a heavy, thick accent. So it's that whole thing of how language, the English language, is tied to your intellectual capacity, right? And those who could articulate themselves better in the English language were seen as more intelligent, and they were given more opportunities, and you were co-opted into the system where you also started believing that, you know, you are the better kind of black, you are the clever black, right? And they tell you that if you carry on like this, your trajectory will be awesome and beautiful. But because we have all these things, you know, that at home you still need to take your cousins to school, you are the first one, even if you want to rebel it, you end up just going with the flow because you know what's at cost, the stuff that I spoke about at the beginning. And so these are the kind of contradictions that we start meeting. And when we meet these contradictions, we have certain decisions that we have to make. We can't afford to just resign. Like, the day that you discover that this place is not for you, you can't just resign, right? You have to continuously, you know, work and operate within that system. And for me, when I went into that system, I found that there's so many things that we've actually written about in policy that I realized that they're not really realistic, right? So the quotas, for example, how people stand up and our states people will stand up and make these great assertions about how South Africa is one of the most progressive countries because we have so many women in parliament and we have CEOs and vice chancellors as women. But we still live in a country where over 50% of, you know, our population lives in poverty, and this is the recorded poverty, which I think the numbers are higher, and most of those people are black women and children, right? And so what does then it mean if we have these quotas, but then here's this reality, right? What does that liberate? Is that being liberated when you still have this, you know, when we still have this gap? And so the corporate world made me think about that. The corporate world also made me think about, you know, the kind of relationship that we have with women who are supposedly in power, and how we never think about the kind of battles that they face as well, right? In these powerful positions, the kind of systems they have to fight, because it's a lonely place, right? And how we at the bottom will have certain expectations and say, but you are at the top, now that means doors must open, etc., etc. And we don't know that this person is going through mental health issues, this person is fighting systems, and we don't think about that. And for me, the corporate chapter made me think about those things, and also made me think about white feminism, right? Because white feminism only talks to the gender wage gap, right? Like, the only problem that we have in society is that men earn this much and women earn this much. Yeah. Let's close the gender gap, and let's, what's that book by that woman?
Let's Lean In.
Let's Lean In, right? And so that was also like a critique on that kind of thinking, and saying, you know, we have these kind of struggles on this continent. We have these kind of struggles in our country. So these You know, so our problems go beyond things like wages. You know, there are women who the last worry in their mind is the 30% wage gap because they're not even allowed to participate. The system doesn't even allow for that, right? But there's also other, all these other factors like gender-based violence. There's all these other factors that sits, you know, around, and if we don't address each one of them, then, you know, basically we are muting certain groups of people. So that, that chapter for me was important to talk about this economic liberalization or economic place that we're always crying about and fighting for, and saying there's context to it. And if we don't think about that context, even when we are earning our 1 mil a year, and even if you are seeing more black faces, there's nothing that, it's not going to bring liberation. That's not the way. And you know, we have political parties that are stressing that economic liberation, we have political power, but without economic liberation, there is no liberation, right? We need to interrogate those statements, because all of us are here thinking, if we are all economic liberated, whatever that means, then all of our problems are gone. And so that chapter kind of just like goes through the hidden stuff that we don't talk about.
So, I mean, speaking of white feminism, which is, I think, a whole discussion on its own, right? And so just how problematic white feminism is, you know? I'm curious about what your own feminism is right now, having written the book, having had time to interrogate, but also in relation to self-care, right? I mean, the Clocknol and I have been talking a lot about just, you know, that Audre Lorde quote about how self-preservation really is just a radical act. And I think that's what self-care is for black women, right? In a world that demands that you all but lay yourself flat so that people can walk all over you, right? And still then complain that you're not flat enough. What is the radical act of self-care actually mean, you know, in relation to your feminism as well?
And I think related to that is to say kudos to you, Malebo. Like, I've read Audre Lorde extensively, and I've read people who've written about Audre Lorde, and I think that in Misbehave, you really are capturing the essence of what Audre Lorde was saying when she says caring for yourself is not self-indulgence, right? It's a radical act of self-preservation. And I think, thinking about where Audre Lorde was at the time when she wrote that, she was suffering through cancer, right? Yeah. And sometimes, see, self-care has become a thing that we talk about, like hashtag,
Giddy bubbles. You know?
Yeah, giddy bubbles, and candles, and ink. And we take away from the meaning of what it is, right? So I suppose when Alma and I were thinking about this, we were thinking about, like, so where do you situate your feminism? Because you end the book by saying, I'm an African feminist. What does that look like? Yeah. And then also, what does that look like in relation to the chapter where you say you're not, this is not a prescription, you know, there are many things, but these are some of the things that you do to take care of yourself.
Yeah. So I think I'll answer the one about my feminism after I've dealt with the self-care. I think, you know, when we think about a time in history, the 1956, you know, march that we all talk about, and the slogans that were like chanted, one which is Imbokodo, right? You realize the situation at that time called for women to present themselves in certain ways, right? And they were supposed to be rocks, right? Because at that time you cannot afford to be anything else, because if we strike you and you bleed, right? And that's the thing, a rock is hard, it's cold, it doesn't bleed, has no emotions, etc. But now I'm thinking about how then a lot of those women, the ways that they died, right? And thinking about my grandmother and the ways that she existed. And I always make this example, if Oyako Kerekeng or anywhere where older women gather, banali mautua, amakima, right? They're always going for high blood tests and whatever. And I, growing up, used to think this is what being an old woman is. For the test. And then that speaks to the, you know, the kind, what the system did to these bodies, right? The system was so brutal that it physically harmed these bodies. Now I asked myself, in existing today, is this how I am going to present myself in fighting these inequalities? Because basically what oppression does to the marginalized body, it says you cannot love, you cannot breathe, You cannot think about joy. You cannot exist in a way where you have agency and you can make decisions for yourself, because you are just the other. You're a slave. You are just an object to be used, right? So if a system of oppression says that about you, you have to have a different response to that. To say, okay, fine, if you're saying I cannot bleed, I am going to claim bleeding, right? I'm going to claim vulnerability. I'm going to claim love and joy. And so in a way, thinking about yourself is a resisting kind of gesture, right? It's to say the system didn't design my oppression for me to think about myself. So I'm going to think about myself, and I'm going to start to dismantle the way the system says who I should be. And one of the ways is that you need to be strong. You need to be this anchor. You know, Musadi Otwarang. Because I literally flash it. Musadi Otwarang tipa ka bukhale, right? Gore ha go ka senyega. All you need is a black woman. Because and then physically you actually think about what that means, right? And then madi atwa and how feel anything. So these are the kind of things that have been put into us, and this is how we need to believe our existence is premised on. And so when you say I'm weak, you can't say you're weak, because umusadi right? And so for me, self-care then, when I read that quote, that it's not an act of self-indulgence, right? It's an act of self-preservation. That actually there is a revolutionary act in preserving yourself, in not being some mature, you know, where you die. You don't have to die physically, but your soul dies early, right? And there's a thing about activists of the past. If you read their life stories, you see Uguti, at the end of their lives, when they wrote, they really reflected a lot about how they embodied themselves and how they took care of themselves. And we, when we try and emulate these activists, we don't really consider that part of their story. We always consider that, hey, Biko was like this, or you know, somebody else was like this. This is how you need to be. And I remember with Fees Must Fall, we were giving out energy drinks. Somebody was like, hey, these activists are today are weak. They're drinking energy drinks, right? And then it's like, so we have to embody that part that kills you and that says you actually, you know, you need to harm yourself, or you need to be able to feel pain in order to validate your existence. And for me, self-care is actually standing against that. It's actually saying, it's actually a revolutionary thing to say I'm tired, to say my mental health is important to me and I'm going to take care of it. You know, to say there are certain things that I will do for my own edification. Because obviously, Jade, you know, how are you going to serve anyone if you're not okay inside? And it's important for us now, for me to start thinking that way. And this is where I was coming with self-care, because I was reflecting on my activism. There was a part where really it had physically, it had taken its toll. I couldn't even do anything anymore. And I was really, I felt guilty trying to think about putting myself first. And when I would confide in my comrades or whoever I was working with at that time, and they would remind me, you're a lioness, you're a pillar, stand up, you know yourself. And at that time I was like, I just can't. And this is how I started to think about how activists are dying, right? And we don't hear those stories. Activists are dying by suicide. Activists are dying by chronic illnesses because of how the system attacks the body. And for us to still do the work, because the work needs to be done, for us to still do the work, we need to preserve ourselves. And there are different ways that we preserve ourselves. And I'm very weary about the self-care that feeds into the capitalist machine, right? I'm talking
the
about
candles.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I love candles, I love bubbles, but beyond the candles, the bubbles, the nail polish, it's things that really make our soul smile. And one of the things that I also realized is when I visited a village last year, that there were certain things that these women were doing. Obviously, there's no English academic language to say self-care, but they were actually doing certain things to preserve themselves, right? And there's a quote that I have that you can find on the internet, you know, I'm quotable.
Yes!
That I talk about how my grandmother knew how to deal with my mental illness way before I knew it was a mental illness. Like the kind of things that she would do, like she would boil some herbs and say, nkap taweli, you know, breathe in, you know, steam sena, right? Or nka tsamorobala ko mobung, and just close your eyes and let the sun you know, shine on you. And if you read like DSMs, like the book of the Tsama psychologist, Barry, if you're really like going into a depressive state, one of the things that you need to do is go sit out there in the sunshine and let the, you know, sun heal you. And you're like, wow, we believe it because ingotiki my psychiatrist vale vakwale, right? But our grandmothers have been doing these things, right? And so it's important to realize that self-care does not need to be elitist. You know, it does not, it's just ways that we find, that we make do. And self-care as well is this, like Ritu Simona, edifying each other, that is self-care. So we must find our safe spaces for self-care. So that's one part. And another part is, I think my book or me just talking has located my feminism, right? My feminism is an inclusive...
A teacher.
Yeah. It's really inclusive, right? It's one of those that as time has gone, we have found lovely words like intersectionality, right?
Thank you, black woman.
Yeah, yes. It's also,
one that really looks inward and say, what kind of privileges? Because being a black woman doesn't mean like I have no privileges, right? Mm-hmm. Sitting in this body, Anna, and I identify with my reproductive organs, and I'm a female and a woman, like a cis heterosexual woman. There are certain privileges that I have over queer people, right? So I understand it's also looking inward and saying, how then do we work together in order for us to achieve this liberation that we talk about? And for me, one of the biggest thing that haunts my feminism is this gap between us well-spoken theorists versus how we then throw our authority around.
You
know, about 20 degree, how we throw and banali the language, banali access to write a book. It doesn't mean, you know, can I access our book, how we see ourselves, you know, versus the entire population, versus how we see ourselves as marginalized bodies. So I think that's really important. It's a kind of critiquing feminism as well. Mm. So yeah.
We can all agree there are quotables on quotables on quotables, like, right? Please give us another book. We've got an amazing audience today. We've got a full house, which is just beautiful.
Of black women mainly. Yes, to black women.
And there are some black men. There are some dear black men. There are a couple of them here. I think we just want to open it up, you know, to any questions that anyone might have. I know that you were just, you know, in your spirits. Malebo was just preaching. So if you have a question, if you have a comment, to give to our award-winning author.
Yeah.
I just have to keep reminding you guys, this is why we need to cite black women, because they're just high achieving and magical. So I just want to open it up to any questions, any comments. Take the floor. The floor is yours.
Any questions? Okay. We can start with the black woman and then we'll move. Yes.
I was in my 20s, like that chapter SEX. I was in my 20s the first time I took a mirror and just looked at my vulva, looked at my vagina, discovered that the clitoris, it's not just that dot, Maria around, and how we've been lied to, and how these men can't even locate this clitoris. You know, just like notions around masturbation, notions around, like just notions around, you know, this place. And for me, it was like, the day I discovered the clitoris, God, no wonder now I feel calm, man, because because now I'm mad, you know. But yeah, you know, I think it really dismantles a lot of how we taught about certain things, and we should be able to do better for ourselves and others. Mm. Yeah.
You have a comment over here? Yeah, or question?
I did a lot. I had a lot of guilt on the one side, you know, they're not especially during those days, hey, there are not a lot of black women in these kind of positions of power, right? And especially being a gender activist, you're always fighting for this, and now you have it, now you're giving up, right? So you have that guilt, number one, and it ties back to that whole strong black women self-care thing that I spoke about. Hore, there's this whole weight of saving a generation placed on you, and you cannot make decisions that are good for your soul, right? And so for me, I lived with that guilt for a very long time. But if you read the chapter, you'll realize that there came a time where I was already dealing with a lot of mental illness, right? And I feel like we should not have people choose between their lives and the country. And this is what we've been doing, right? We've been putting a lot of people's lives on the line. And it took me years for me to release myself from that guilt, because if I was there, I could have employed a lot of black people. If I was there, I could have changed policies. Then only later I realized that's all lies. And that's why I unpack it in the book of once we are aware of what's happening, we can unpack these lies and realize. So for me, that decision that I made was out of self-care, right? And there's another person who would make a different decision. That's the beautiful thing about choice. And the work that we do continues in different avenues that we at. So being out of corporate has allowed me to think deeper about that machine and how it is, and I can speak out against it without fearing that I'm going to lose my job. I've gone into the academic space where I can write extensively about it. So in that sense, it has worked out well, right? On the other side, there's that whole guilt of when we talk about it, black tax, right? Where your family really holds you in high regard because, my level seven, it's like, wow, regular dikolo, it's a son, it's a ing. And having to walk away from that is a disappointment to your family and to the black nation. And I do realize that the choice that I had was a privileged choice of walking away, because not everyone can. And it's not a thing that I advise people to do, because we all come from different backgrounds. And I was in a place where I had a supportive family, right, who said, okay, fine, you know, you want to leave corporate, we will kind of support you in these ways, but, you know, you can't be our burden forever. And not everyone has that. And those are the complexities that we must understand, that some people continue to die in corporate, but they don't have that choice because they will not be able to take care of themselves and their families. You know, if you had the privilege of generational wealth where if you left, you could just travel the world and, you know, daddy's money is there to help you, it would be great. But that also speaks to the generation, the systematic issues that we've had that have been brought on by apartheid, right? And it makes me think about this issue that this story, Sabo Oprah, Zahori, you can dream it and achieve it. All you have to do is think about it and you will achieve it, right? How true is that when it comes to black people? You can't just dream and achieve it. You work hard, but you don't always succeed, right? Because there are things that are placed in the way of your success. So for me, I know I went out of your question, but that's the nature of the game. But yeah, I think those were the guilts that I really struggled with. And I still struggle with a lot of guilt, and this is why it's a journey. But writing about them and thinking about them together can really save us from being locked by those guilt, because this is how, you know, we get caught, you know, through being held into these guilt systems. Like, if when are we tlokomela? Like, if you have kids and you say, I don't want to deal with these kids right now, you are guilt tripped into why you're the mother, right? So yeah, so it's a journey, but I've long released myself from that.
Also, I think you said something interesting in your book in relation to that, where you spoke about people being co-opted into the system.
Yeah.
So often we guilt trip people in staying in the system, because we're like, how are you gonna change it from the outside, you know? But I mean, this is a well-known quote, so, you know, the master's tools will never dismantle his house, you know? And I mean, how once you see people in the system finding it very difficult, because like you're saying, you get accustomed to being the only black at the table, and it's nice, and everyone wants to feel exceptional, and everyone wants to feel like, you know, they are the ones.
Yeah.
You know, you're the one who's so great, you made it. And I think really the question that comes out of that is, how do we not necessarily recreate the systems that we find ourselves in when we're inside, but how do we create new systems that are inclusive of the values that we hold, right? Are we trying to say that when you're in that corporate system that demands that you force your workers to come in early and doesn't take into account apartheid spatial architecture and transport constraints, for example, right? Or doesn't take into account the various backgrounds that people have. So while Tlhokonolo may not be articulate in the ways that Malebo is and then disadvantages him, right? Or do we then create new systems instead of trying to co-opt old systems that were never created for us to start off with? You know? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the real conversation to be had. Instead of saying, we need more black people in the JSE, maybe we don't. Hmm. Maybe we just don't need more black people in the JSE.
Maybe we just need to burn it down.
I think there's no question.
Oh yeah, I mean, all there are like people that are still trying to forgive me from that time, right? Really outspoken. I received like backlash during that time, but I was just so into what I was doing, and I believed in it so much that it didn't make sense why they were attacking me, because I believed that we need to work together for us to find this liberation. And working together meant black women had to do all the job, right? And so, so at that time I did get this whole thing of, you're a gender activist, this is what your organization is on, why is it that you're at this place? And I think one of the things that freed me when I started reflecting on it, one of the things that freed me is I asked one poet a question about writing yourself, right, and all the different changes that you go through. Because especially being a writer or someone in the public space, you might say something in 1998, and then in 2018, you have a different view, and every time you go back to it, you cringe, right? And then I thought about, there's certain things that I've written at that time, even as a gender activist, that if I read today, I'm like, oh my God, they shouldn't find that, Twitter shouldn't find that, because wow, so shuba, right? And then she said something about, you know, the contradictions that we find ourselves as these marginalized people, right? That we have different, that the conditioning that we have is not naturally ours, it's always from an oppressive system. When we come out of that oppressive system, there are different changes in the ways that we see ourselves. And as a writer, somebody who writes, you need to write those changes into history so that people can follow that journey. And so how I reconciled that was the fact that I became quite reflective on it and said, I named myself before I could be named, right? I said, here's this thing that I used to do, and this is how I thought about it, and this is how I came out of it to a place that where I am, and how I'm accounting for it. Because you need to account. And I think the thing that happens on Twitter is when something that you said 10 years ago is contradicting what you're saying today, and it gets posted, we don't want to account for that, right? We want to defend ourselves, and we want to say, I was stupid when I was younger, this is why I wrote this. You know, we do all sorts of things, right? We don't account, and we don't name the system for what it is. And these are teaching moments for us to say, this is how the journey happens with all of us. Yours, it might have been in secret. Mine is just amplified, and this should be used as a teaching moment. And I think this is what Misbehave, that especially the Dear Black chapter, was seeking to do. That's why I was really open and honest about where I was and how the journey unfolded to a certain place. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, English is not our thing. And this idea of us trying to do English gymnastics for me, and how then this academic language, where was it created? And why is it that when we hear, we advocate, and Kirona, the big advocate, if someone from the UK comes and gives a paper in South Africa, they use the most simplest word, right? And I'm just, okay, fine, not all the time, but you know what I'm saying, right? So for me as well, as being accessible is a way to rebel within the academic spaces. And then it forces us to start our own journals, because there's so many journals that I've submitted my work to. I always get, this is powerful, but maybe the writing style is not appropriate for this journal, right? And I'm like, well, then maybe I don't want to be published in your journal. So maybe my academic credentials won't, like, you know, flourish like I wished they would. And so maybe we must start our own journals that we make important. So just a very academic answer. Yeah.
No,
so,
thank,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I thought that even the questions was very important. I like Gahiso's comment, because I think that what it's forcing us to do is what you're saying, starting our own sort of academic way of thinking, right? Because like sometimes, like you guys, you just want to write, like just I'm having a conversation and I just want to write, and then they're like, oh no, it doesn't have pedagogy, you know, and hegemony, and you're like, I don't know what they mean, you know, I don't know what they mean, that's why I'm not using them. So thank you. I think thank you also for
writing
Misbehave, but also for doing an academic piece of work, because I think people think that Misbehave is just a book that you read, but actually it's a citation. I've cited it in the academic papers that I've written, because I think that it's doing the same work that these other journals are doing, right? So thank you really for that, Malebo. You know, we're at the Chickenators, we're in the serious business of doing another big word, reparations, you know? So we must apportion you some much deserved land, right? For people who are listening to the podcast for the first time, we do this really interesting thing. We don't give books, we don't give popcorn, you know, like, no man, those are small things, like we give people land. And what we do is Alma and I deliberate extensively
at the land committee that we head up,
and we talk, and we're like, we're thinking, we need to give my label, or we need to give this writer this piece of land because this writing was this and this writing was that, right? And so we know when you're writing part of Misbehave that you were
seaside.
Looking at the seaside, right?
Yeah.
Because we think you enjoy writing at the seaside.
The ocean breeze just does something for you. You
know?
Take some walks to contemplate the next chapter.
The fire that you're
touching my brain.
So after much deliberation and I mean careful consideration, you know, at the land committee, the Klokonol and I have decided that in light of the powerful work that Misbehave has done and continues to do all over the world. It's being translated into different languages. My label gets quoted in different languages. Wow. All
Kimberly
over
Crenshaw
the world.
And Cheryl Harris have a copy of your book in their libraries.
So, yes.
My grandmother has a copy.
Yes.
Even her.
Even her. So we've decided that we're going to give my label a piece of land at Kenton-on-Sea. All right, yeah. and I think this is just a testament to the wonderful work that Misbehave has done and continues to do. Part of the work that the Chickenators does is to create a canon of black literature and of black people speaking about themselves for themselves. I think that there's a freedom that you experience when you know that you are writing for people who look like you and who will receive the book in the ways that it needs to be received. And I mean, just from the comments we've had and the questions we've had today, you can tell that Misbehave is doing really important and powerful work, and that even in 10, 20 years, right, it's going to be quoted by young black feminists who are going to be like, I found a piece of myself in this work that made me realize that I was not alone. And this is what we mean when we talk about representation. So on behalf of the Chickenatives, we want to congratulate my label for the brilliant work that Misbehave has done and continues to do as an award-winning text.
Yes.
Not that these awards validate our work, but it's very important to note that black literature is excellent, and it's not just fun and beautiful, but it's rigorous academic work, and that rigorous academic work doesn't need to look like hegemony and pedagogy and all these other things that we just don't use in our everyday life. I don't know about y'all, I don't know about that with my friends. But I mean, just congratulations, Malibu. We're so, so proud of you, and we're so happy to have just been a part of this moment, right? And we look forward to what's coming next.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the question is to ask Malebo, what can we expect from the award-winning author?
So, firstly, when this book was launched, these were my discussants, right? And they had only one podcast at that time with Mohale Mashiko. Can you believe that after I've been loyal to them and followed them, I'm only being featured after 75 podcasts. Oh, wow. Can you believe I've been bitter, but today my bitterness has been lifted. So thank you. It's such an honor as an author to be featured on their podcast. And I was wondering, what's wrong with me? So, I mean, they do really important work. Thank you for prioritizing our voices, for actually resurrecting these muted voices. What's coming next? Well, I don't know if I should say this.
Say it, girl. So, speak your truth.
I was really, you know, as a writer, when you release your first book, there's this whole pressure of when is your second book coming, right? And you end up so pressured and you write nonsense, right? Because you don't even know what you're writing. You just write. And then I read a quote by Sade. Is it Sade or Sade?
Sade.
where she said that she doesn't release things for the sake of just releasing. Mm. She releases things that want to come out, right? Mm. And I think I was busy with the second book and I realized that maybe it's not time for it to come out. So what's next? It's my PhD.
Yeah!
It's time I get that red gown.
Red gown.
Because there are places and spaces where when you do occupy in jail, you know. So haki apere red gown when the second book comes.
Yes.
Yeah. Doctor, so please, who knows? Didn't edit him or podcasting, ne? You can send her a good like paper.
I mean, again, like just to echo what Alma was saying. Thank you, really, Malebo, for one writing Misbehave, but also for blessing us with your presence, you know, and having these conversations with us. And also thank you to a very like important, engaged audience. We really appreciate you. And also thank you to our resident bookstore, which allows us to record podcasts, Bridge Books. Obviously, you can get Malebo Sipodi's book at bookstores around South Africa. Internationally, it's on Amazon. You can also do that if you are in the Pasheas and you're listening to us from the Pasheas. If you get a Bridge Books, you can get a 10% discount using Cheeky. Please don't email Malebo and ask her for a PDF copy. She doesn't deal in PDFs. She deals in e-wallets.
Yes! Please, can 2019 just be the year where people are better? Just be better, you know? Don't borrow the book and then don't give it back to your friend. Can you just be better? Like, don't ask the author for a copy just because you and her were in primary school together. Stop this thing. Just be better. It's 2019. Let's all be better, you know? But once again, thank you to everybody who came to Bridge Books on a Saturday afternoon with the sun out, just to continue to honor Black authors. You know, when we see Black audiences honoring Black authors, it just gives, I think it edifies their work, but it also gives strength to the movement. So thank you guys.
Let's Misbehave!
Yeah!